You are listening to the Teaching Little Brains podcast with Sarah Nicaruk, episode 54. Hello, teacher brain. I've got some super fun facts about our brains to kick us off today before we dive into something called the DMN, your brain's default mode network. All right, so did you know that your brain is 75% water? And of the remaining portion, 60% of that is fat. Did you know that your brain represents only 2% of your body weight, but consumes 20% of your energy? How about this? To feed those energy needs, it has around 100,000 miles of blood vessels. That's like four times around the earth, through which it absorbs 20% of your body's oxygen supply. Crazy! Your brain generates up to 23 watts of power, which is enough to light up a room. Did you know that left-handed and ambidextrous people have 11% more tissue in the corpus callosum, which is the region of the brain that connects the left and right sides together? And between birth and 18 years old, your brain triples in size. And although it doesn't grow bigger after that, it does keep adding surface area in a series of ever more complex folds. So it's good to have wrinkles on your brain. You also have a brain in your heart. And I touched on this in episode 21. So your heart has a collection of neurons with its own nervous system. Also, each of your energy centers, which we sometimes know as chakras, each of those also has its own brain. So Joe Dispenza talks about this, and I think I mentioned this before in the episode about tapping, episode 22. Dr. Joe shares that each chakra has its own specific energy that carries a corresponding level of consciousness, its own emission of light expressing very specific information. Each also has its own individual glands, hormones, chemistry, and individual plexus of neurons. So think of these little individual clusters of neurological networks as mini brains. If each one of these centers has its own individual brain, then each and consciousness, then each one also has its own individual mind. Crazy! And although human beings have evolved greatly, our brains have not changed much over the past, I don't know, millions of years, especially in terms of brain function. So our hind brain, also known as the reptile brain or lizard brain, which is responsible for survival functions like respiration, digestion, reproduction, and sleep, was the first part to evolve around 600 million years ago, and it hasn't changed much. In fact, dinosaurs had very similar hindbrains to the ones that we have now. Now, that being said, some significant changes have occurred throughout history. For example, about 150 million years ago, mammals entered the scene and brought with them the limbic system, where memory, emotional bonding, learning, regulating body heat, and other cool things originates. Since early human beings started making tools about 3 million years ago, our brain has tripled in size. However, our brain is very much still hardwired for survival, and that instinct can hijack the whole operation if we're not careful. And by careful, I mean aware and conscious of what our brain is doing and how we're using it. So within our brain, we have neurons, and neurons connect with each other using extensions called synapses. A single neuron can have up to 7,000 synapses and network with thousands of other neurons through these synapses. And when you stimulate a neural bundle by passing information through it, by having a thought, the number of synapses increases. That's neuroplasticity. When you stop using a neural pathway, it begins to shrink or atrophy. And this is the basis of the neurocoaching model. It's called synaptic pruning. We prune away the neural pathways that are running the information that you don't want. We stop using those and we build new neural pathways to run the information, the thoughts and beliefs that you do want. That's neuroplasticity. And that's how you get actual brain-based lasting transformation. We strengthen the pathways that we want, and therefore they run things faster and more automatically for us. And this is what we want to get into today, talking about our default mode of our brain. But this is also why it can be hard to break a habit or change a behavior, because your physical neural pathways are so strong. The information you've been passing through them has gotten a lot of practice, and that connection is well built. So after about 3 weeks, though, the brain notices when you're not sending information through that channel anymore and begins to disassemble it. And this is where the idea or notion or suggestion of something taking 21 days to build a habit comes from. And while that's partially true, it's not the whole picture. Because in fact, at about 21 days, because your brain is starting to notice that you're not using this pathway that it believes is safe because it's familiar, it starts to kick up a fuss. So when you're trying to break a habit or ditch an old, unhelpful, untrue, and limiting belief, at around 3 weeks, it does start to prune. But because of that, again, your brain says, wait a second, what's happening here? And kicks up a fuss, and you can experience frustration, and you can find yourself thinking thoughts that bring you back in there. And if you're not pushing on, you can end up right back where you started. It's like when you stretch out an elastic. So you pull it and pull it and pull it. And just at the point where it's about to break, if you don't keep pulling, is where it will snap back with the most force. So you have to keep pulling, right? It's easier said than done. And it's often sadly when most people give up right before they're about to break through, because that's the point of most resistance. But if you keep going, if you keep pulling, and you keep intentionally choosing the thoughts and practicing the beliefs and doing your brain priming, which is one of the most impactful tools and practices of the neurocoaching program, then as you prune away that old thought, you simultaneously are building up strength in the new pathway and physically growing it larger and to operate faster. So not 21 days, but on the average 67-ish days to build a solid pathway that is now stronger than the old one. At 21 days, both are around equal strength if you've been doing the work, the brain priming and the other tools. But the old one will win out if you let up, because it's the one that has had the most practice. Remember, your brain is always trying to keep you safe, and to it, safety means what is familiar. When you're trying to kick a habit, you need a new one to replace it with. So in terms of neuroplasticity, your old habit of thought that you're trying to replace, we need a new thought or belief to replace that old one with. And that's why the first step is to really be clear and honest about what that is, to define it with detail. Because here's the thing, your brain's going to go after whatever you tell it to. And if you're telling it to go after something that you don't really want because you're scared to admit what you do really want, because you're holding back on what you really want, either out of fear of what others might think or because you don't believe you can have it. Hello, Henry Ford. Yet, and I promise you, you can. You're going to get whatever you do believe you can have or whatever you do show your brain. And you don't want to turn around in 67 or 90 days having held back, or even 21 days, and think, oh, crap, I am not heading where I wanted to go. Like, what a waste of time. So get clear on what you want, declare it. And then we'll define the habit of thought that you need to practice in order to build that new pathway and prune away the old. And again, this is where a coach is invaluable. Believe me, I have a bunch. So find someone who can guide you, not someone who's going to tell you what to do and that you kind of give all your power away to, but or tell you that their way is the only way, but someone who will empower you to lean into the person that you want to be, someone who will hold your vision for you and not let you snap that elastic back. The reason why a coach is so helpful in this endeavor, and I don't just mean me, I mean, I can help you. I'm qualified, I'm certified, I'm really good at this, but I could be the juiciest peach on the tree and you just may not like peaches, and that's okay. So find a strawberry or an apple or a watermelon or whatever your fruit of choice may be. But the reason why a coach is so helpful is because they're one step removed from your stuff. We're too close to our own stuff to really see what's happening. We're too attached to our own stories. And you know this is true. It is so easy to see what someone else should do or what someone else could do. It's easy to help your friends. It's so clear to you what is happening with your students or other little brains in your life. Like, why can't they just see it? It's because everybody's just too close to their own stuff. And so a coach will push you, lovingly, of course, where you likely wouldn't go on your own. We tend to hold back when it's just ourselves. We let our fears stop us from doing things we want to do or know are good for us. But a coach will, again, out of love, not allow you to hold on to those limiting beliefs. She or he will help shift your perspective and belief in yourself and just get you there a lot faster and give you kind of the permission to do the things that you would let yourself off for if you were trying to do this alone. And oh my goodness, I just can't tell you how grateful I am that I started working with a coach and for my own coaching training. Like, it literally has changed my life. But anyway, you've heard me say this many, many times, but it's all about your thoughts and feelings, your stories, your beliefs, the lies that your brain has been formulating as you've been growing up. And when we accept the beliefs that we've collected over our lives without our permission or even knowledge, we've been taking it all in when we were young, and we don't examine those, we just take them in without question, we end up holding back and we refrain and we suffer. And by suffer, I just mean we indulge in an emotion that doesn't help us and in fact makes us feel most of the time physically uncomfortable. So for example, my form of suffering before I learned all this was like frustration. I would just be frustrated or overwhelmed. And then we wallow in that. And that doesn't feel good. And that becomes a form of suffering. This is what I mean by suffering. So what is your form of suffering? Do you wallow in overwhelm or indecision or resentment or worry? What is your form of suffering? Byron Katie, whom if you've never heard of, you can Google her. She's a leader in thought work and perspective shifts and a lovely human being. She says of her own breakthrough, "I discovered that when I believed my thoughts, I suffered. But when I didn't believe them, I didn't suffer." And ultimately, what that means is suffering is optional. Everything is a choice. Think about that for a second. You can choose everything. Every moment of your day is a choice. You can choose whether or not you want to suffer. You can choose whether or not you want to cook dinner tonight or pick up your kids from school or pay your taxes or even breathe for that matter. And sometimes it doesn't feel like a choice, but that's really just about the consequences. You always have a choice. You're not free from the consequences of those choices. If you don't pay your taxes, what's going to happen? If you don't cook dinner, what's going to happen? If you don't pick up your kids from school, what will happen? So you choose to do those things because you don't like the consequences if you don't, but everything is a choice. And if we switch our language, again, language is so important. Instead of saying, I have to do these things. Oh, I have to cook dinner. I've got to do my taxes. I have to pick up my kids from school. We say, I get to, or I choose to. That's a great step. And that can be so empowering. Okay. So although your brain represents only 2% of your body's mass, it consumes 20% of its energy. And here's the interesting part. Your brain consumes the same amount of energy, whether it's engaged in a demanding task or it's at rest. When you're engaged in an attention-intensive activity, like planning your lessons, taking attendance, composing an email to your administrator, repairing your toaster, navigating your way through a new city, your brain revs up to max power. And an area called the TPN, the Task Positive Network, which includes areas of the prefrontal cortex and the parietal lobe that handle functions like working memory, cognitive awareness, and attention, gears up. But when you're sitting in your backyard, soaking up the sun's rays, or going for a leisurely stroll in nature, or when you just sit down to meditate or have 5 seconds to yourself, your brain is still consuming 20% of your body's energy. In fact, scans show that the energy usage of your brain rarely varies by more than 5% up or down throughout the day. Dawson Church, author of Bliss Brain, which is an amazing book, which is the source of much of the information in this episode, likens it to a car engine that keeps revving even when it's idle. And it turns out that your brain is highly active even when you're doing nothing. But it's also running on autopilot most of the time, right? Like we know that it's 80 to 95% of the time. And this autopilot is called the default mode network, DMN, or fittingly, as Dawson Church calls it, the demon in your brain. And in my Be the Boss of Your Brain series available through Lights On, one of the modules that I cover is around this autopilot. And as it turns out, that autopilot is a demon or acts like a demon. It's not really a DMN. So when you're at rest, your brain defaults to this negative state. So interesting. So when you're not engaged in lesson planning or toaster repair or driving in a new city, this is where your brain will go. Now, I'm not religious, so I don't know the Bible, but I think there's like a quote about the devil and an idle brain, or maybe it's idle hands. But either way, it applies here. When your brain is idle, the DMN is activated. The DMN has a rich neural network connecting to other brain regions. So the prefrontal cortex, impairing executive function like memory, attention, flexibility, inhibition, planning, and problem solving. And the posterior cingulate cortex and insula. So it essentially connects the front of your brain with the back of your brain. The insula is the region that integrates information from other parts of the brain, namely those with neurons triggered by emotions that we feel toward other people. So resentment, embarrassment, lust, and contempt. So we don't just think negative thoughts, we feel them too. And when the DMN takes over, you start to remember all the bad stuff that happened in your life, like the time you spoke up in class and everyone laughed at you. The other time you asked someone out and they rejected you, when you tried out for the soccer team and didn't make it, and how about that time you really put yourself out there and applied for a job that you told everyone about and then you didn't get it. And then it projects all of those disasters into the future, ruminating on things like, what if it happens again? And we mentally rehearse all of these imagined negative possible triggers of harm. Your hippocampus gets in there, and you may have heard about the hippocampus if you've ever taught or used the Mind Up curriculum before. It kind of goes through that, but it's the seahorse-shaped structure in the center of the limbic system. and is responsible for memory. And specifically, its most vital job is to compare incoming information with the memory of past threats. And if there's no match, then the hippocampus is quiet. But if there is a match, it triggers the amygdala, which is the brain's alarm system, that either allows in what is deemed safe or kicks in the fight, flight, or freeze response if it's unsafe. Hopefully this is making you feel a bit better about your racing negative mind. I know it did for me. It helps to know that just like when we feel any emotion, nothing has gone wrong. When we think negative thoughts, nothing has gone wrong. Our brains are designed this way. But why? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you can probably predict what I'm going to say next. Your brain presents these negative thought options as an ancient survival technique. It's why you're here, actually. It kept your ancestors alive. They had to think about the snakes they saw on the path last week, the snake that almost bit them 2 years ago, the snake they might see on the path tomorrow in order to survive. It was crucial to focus a lot of their brain power on the bad stuff that could happen. Being anxious about the future was highly adaptive to our ancestors. Being miserable about the things that happened in the past helped them ingrain in their memory all the dangers so that they didn't make the same mistake twice. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Remember, learning happens when you combine information and emotion. So the information of the snake plus the emotion of worry or fear. I now have learned to watch out for snakes because last time, you know, my brother got bit by it and got really sick. So those who missed the signs of dangers, even sometimes by a fraction of a second back then, didn't survive. So the person who saw the tiger in the bushes last was the one that got eaten. And then fast forward a few millennia and here we are. All of those traits, all of that scanning for negative threats has been passed down and really honed. We have honed the skill of noticing and responding to even the faintest whisper of a remote possibility of a threat and abandoning all happiness in the process because happiness serves no purpose when you're being chased by a tiger. Mother Nature cares greatly about your survival and not at all about your happiness. That is something you have to consciously choose and practice. And you need to give yourself some grace. After all, as we just outlined, you're working against about 150 million years of practice. So it's going to take a hot minute to break that habit, which is what makes this 67-day process pretty darn impressive, if you ask me. And it's also why just thinking positively doesn't work, right? Because it's so ingrained. You need to prune that old belief away and build a new one physically in your brain. But that's an episode for another day. So again, this is not bad. Nothing has gone wrong. Nothing is wrong with you because this is happening. In fact, it's a sign that you have a high functioning brain in your head. So be grateful for that. It's why you know not to touch the hot stove or stick your finger in the socket. It's not bad. It's just a bit excessive for our generally safe modern world. We don't fear tigers in the bushes when we go to the grocery store, right? There aren't that many poisonous snakes along our path in our day-to-day life. It'd be like wearing a hard hat and protective goggles to have tea with your friend. Unless your tea date is on a construction site where that would be completely appropriate, it's a bit much. And it's really annoying. I mean, you go for a nice walk to get some peace of mind. You sit down to get some peace and quiet for like 5 minutes or meditate and boom, your brain starts pulling out all the bad stuff that happened to you in your past and all the stuff you should be worried about happening in the future. The ants come marching in, the demon or DMN starts chattering at you, telling you all kinds of lies about the dangers you face. You get anxious about the future and depressed about the past, and that pulls you out of that beautiful meditative state. It interrupts your moment of peace and intrudes on your walk. And it's why many people give up on meditating in the first place, in fact, because One, they assume that meditation means silencing their mind, which it isn't and is not possible. And two, when they fail at silencing their mind, they throw in the towel. Which is ironic because one of the most efficient and effective ways to override that default and quiet that DMN is to meditate. There was a study done that showed that within 8 weeks of regular guided meditation, the guided part is important because it brings you into bliss brain, which is a good feeling state, by activating what Dawson Church calls the enlightenment circuit much faster than you can achieve on your own. And you can find Dawson Church's guided meditations on YouTube and on the Insight Timer app. But it builds up your dentate gyrus by almost 23% within 8 weeks. And the dentate gyrus regulates emotion across multiple regions of the brain. So in just 8 weeks of regular meditation, it has been found to grow significantly. This means that you're able to activate the enlightenment circuit more easily and frequently and outside of meditation once you hone that skill. And the more time you spend with that circuit activated, like when you practice meditation, even for 15 minutes a day, you turn that state of feeling good into a trait so that you override the default network. You tame the demon. Activating these circuits day after day strengthens that enlightenment circuit and your dentate gyrus. And you begin to create space and pause between a stimulus and your emotional response. So it becomes a response and not a reaction. And you become a more stable person who lives in bliss brain more often than not. And what do I mean by bliss brain? So I mentioned that it's a good feeling state, but it's not just about the good feeling state. It's actually a measurable electromagnetic state and a chemical state too. It's a unique cocktail of hormones and neurotransmitters, including oxytocin, the cuddle hormone. We heard about that before. The one that we get from the physical touch of those we love. Oh, remember physical touch? So nice. The physical touch of those we love. Anandamide, nitric oxide, which makes your blood vessels bigger and makes you alert. Beta endorphins, which is natural morphine, like 3 times stronger than the synthetic morphine that we give people in the hospital. Dopamine, we know about that one. Serotonin, which is the same stuff that is in magic mushrooms. Psilocybin. And all this is happening when you're in that deep state. And that's what it means to be in bliss brain. You just feel really good. And the beautiful part is once you start to experience this, you'll want to experience it more and more. And so your, I don't have time to meditate becomes wild horses couldn't keep me from meditating. And why not double down? Share this benefit with the little brains you teach or live with and bring them into the mix and work meditation into your daily teaching practice. Like feed 2 birds with 1 seed, as they say. Help them activate this wonderful feeling state. Imagine those little brains having these tools, developing their emotional intelligence, honing their ability to take a pause and respond from a thoughtful place to a situation rather than reacting hotly from their amygdala. And like I said, you can find guided meditations on YouTube, or the Insight Timer app is a good one. Or some boards have purchased Headspace for their staff. And that is a great app. And you can use it with the kids. It has guided. It has micro meditation moments. So they're like 1 to 3 minutes. So you can build up the stamina. But all of those are great places to find that. Also check out episode 41 of this podcast for more information about the benefits of meditation in general. But beyond meditation, one of the things you can do, and again, this is good for you and the little brains in your life, is name your demon. So, or you can call it a monster or ants or whatever you or they picture it as, but you give it a name. And when you name it, you tame it. And it can be like a silly or funny personal name, Or just like a name of somebody that comes to their head. So like Larry or Spike or Devin the Demon or, you know, Hugo, whatever. And if you can't think of a name, a cool thing to do is ask it its name. So you just kind of sit for a second and you say, all right, DMN, what is your name? Or, all right, silly voice, what is your name? And then whatever name comes to your brain, use that one. Or you can call it something you can just describe it. So you could be like, oh, that stinky demon, or those silly ants, or that crazy monster, or whatever. And then draw it, or have the kids draw it, and describe it. What color is it? How big is it? What does it look like? What does it sound like? And I actually do a visualization exercise in my coaching where we imagine those naysayers shrink down and disappear into a puff of smoke when they come up. So that's another strategy you can use. But the purpose of this is to create separation between your identity and that voice that's nattering at you. It's not your choice. It doesn't have your permission. So creating this separation helps your brain visualize it as something that it can control, like a bug to squash, something external. And then it takes kind of the blame and the pressure and judgment and ownership away from you. And you can visualize that as well, like squashing a bug, play with it. Then whenever you find your mind wandering down that dark alley and your DMN kicks in, then you can thank it. So thank your DMN, because remember, it's not doing anything wrong. It's just keeping you safe and it's only doing what it knows. So thank it by name. Oh, there's Larry again. Thanks, Larry. I don't need you right now, so I'm going to give you a hug and you're going to go sit back there in the corner while I go kick ass at this job interview. And you can visualize Larry or whomever doing whatever works for you, sitting in the corner, flying away, poofing away in a puff of smoke, whatever, shrinking down to nothing. And then bring your awareness back to what you need to focus on. Because sometimes that DMN is helpful in keeping you safe. Like I said, not burning yourself or sticking your finger in the socket. But sometimes you just really don't need it. Ultimately, remember though that you are the boss of your brain. You get to decide what you focus on, which means what you bring into your reality. So that was a bit of a doozy, but I hope you found it as fascinating as I did. It's so neat learning this stuff. I just love it. And I love sharing it with you. I would also love to hear how you like it and how you're using it with the little brains in your life. So please leave me a review or send me a private message. You can find me on all the socials at either Sarah Nickerock or Teaching Little Brains. And thank you so much for coming out today. You have been listening to the Teaching Little Brains podcast with Sarah Nickerock. Until next week, keep that DMN at bay, activate your enlightenment circuit, and hang out in Bliss Brain for a while. Bye for now.